Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 70 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, aka All Day Ray, aka Giacomo. And I'm joined here by my affable co-host, former market maker of 20 years and current day retail trader, a man who feels most comfortable with two burner phones, a Rolodex, and a pack of Marlboro menthols. He's bit for more poisonous fruit than Adam and Eve. Of course, I'm talking about VWAP Trader 1, JJ.
How's it going, brother? Man? Good, brother. How are you?
I'm doing great. And our guest today is a trader who is best known for his market wizard status, being profiled in Jack Schwager's new Market Wizards, a man who was president and founder of Trendstat Capital, author of two books. He runs enjoytheride.world, an educational website for traders. Of course, I am talking about the man singing bass in the choir, Tom Basso. Tom, how's it going, man?
And I really do sing bass in the choir.
I know you do. Basso is bass in Italian.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's always, I always enjoy when I get a fellow Italian on the podcast. I know we were talking a little bit briefly before.
Yeah.
Tom, if you were forced into a final meal scenario, what Italian dish are you picking?
That's a tough one, but I really like that osso buco. Depends on how they prepare it, but saltim bocca lights up my mouth pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Love Italian sausage in any way.
Absolutely.
I'm going to make Friday night. I'm taking chicken breasts and plumping them up with brine and then slicing them down the middle. And I'm stuffing them with Italian sausage and Italian cheese, Fontina cheese, and doing a stuffed breast. And I'll do a sort of a brown sauce for it.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
It should be pretty delightful.
Sounds it. I'm a huge fan of the sauce, the Italian sausage, right up my alley. Love it.
Yeah.
I've known you. I know you've dabbled a little bit in winemaking. Mm-hmm. How's that endeavor going?
Well, I don't do it commercially. I do it for friends. I create 28 bottles at a batch out of about a 30 batch juice that's brought into the house. And I lose about a bottle and a half to two bottles as I go through the stages, and you leave the dregs in the bottom of the barrel or the carboy that you're working out of. And so little by little, you lose a little. And then I probably bottle somewhere around 28, sometimes 28 and a fraction bottles, and screw top only. I love screw tops. I make it easy. It doesn't last long because I don't put preservatives in it, which means a lot of my friends who are allergic to sorbates and things like that love my wine. And it doesn't last long, but because of the lack of preservatives, but it never seems to last long because we drink it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to do new batches about every year. So usually Amarone is my favorite, which is a very expensive wine in at the liquor store. Mm-hmm. And I make it for probably somewhere between $12 to $15 a bottle.
Okay.
Because I reuse the bottles. And so it's
excellent. Excellent.
Save a little money, have more money in my portfolio.
There you go. Man of many talents. So just a reminder to the listeners, if you'd like to join JJ, myself, and a supportive community of traders, you can join us at microefutures.com. Tom, you when you graduated college, you did not go right into trading. You started in another field. So can you just tell the listeners how you made your way into trading?
Well, I started out as a chemical engineer, and I loved it. It was a great career while it lasted, but I realized very quickly that if you've designed one pump or one heat exchanger, you've pretty much designed them all. It's more of the same. You're filling out a bunch of materials properties and the chemicals that you're dealing with, say for a heat exchanger, the flow rates, and you do some thermodynamic calculations. The computer does most of the heavy lifting, and out comes the design for a heat exchanger, depending on what you're trying to do, a tube heat exchanger or whatever. And so after about 5 years, I'd been promoted. I was getting the top rankings in my company for my age group and level. Was promoted right away, became a senior engineer, was on my way to becoming a general engineer. and ended up transferring over to the business side and starting an MBA program. And at the same time, I was getting very, very interested in stock trading. Met another couple of fellows at my company that were also chemical engineers and also were heavily into stocks. One of them was managing 600,000 of other people's monies on his own at night, just friends. And the other fellow and myself had started an investment club, and we were essentially default managing the investment club. So the three of us decided to get together. That became Kennedy Capital back in, I think, 1980, roughly. And one thing led to another. I decided to leave and do Trendstat, and then I could control my own destiny, which I did, and eventually moved the company to Scottsdale, Arizona, which is where I ended up shutting it down at around 2003 and retiring. Mm-hmm. So I've had a smile on my face ever since that day. It's, you know, the constant responsibilities of managing like $600 million at the peak and hire, you know, 10 people and 40 computers and downlinks and audits from both the future side, the NFA and the SEC or the state of Arizona. The IRS came in one time. It's just a constant people looking over your shoulder, asking you questions, wanting to see your files. And I have none of that now. I have four accounts now, two for my wife, two for me. Life is good.
Yeah. Yeah. Very well. And I believe how you met Jack Schwager, it was at a Van Tharp conference. Who, you know, one of the guys we trade with, I mean, he can't harp enough on Van Tharp. How well he was. What was that that meeting like with Jack when you guys first met?
Yeah, Jack was I guess apparently the story goes, and this is Jack telling it, that a lot of people were talking to him about, you know, you got to interview this Basso guy for your next book. He's got some interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jack would look over at my returns, and Jack was always into, he was a typical New York trader, I want to say, in the old days. I don't know whether he's mellowed quite a bit these days, but very caffeinated, would think nothing of staying up all night and writing a chapter of the book or something like that. He very intense. And at that point, he was at, I think it was Prudential Base, director of research, if I remember, or something, but he was starting to do the next book. And Tharp, who was in the first book, said, Jack, you really ought to interview him. And Jack said, you know, I look at Basso's returns. They're kind of boring. It's kind of tame. You know, I don't know if the editor would want anything. It doesn't, you know, doesn't have that pizzazz that we look for. And, so, you know, a lot of the other traders in the book are these guys shooting for the hundreds of percent return, thousands of percent returns. They're day traders, floor traders. They're leveraged. Quite a lot of them don't exist anymore because they, you know, blew out or went bankrupt or whatever, or retired or died or whatever. But finally, Tharp was using me as what he called a model trader. So a weekend peak performance seminar would go through and he'd give a lot of technology on trading from the mental side. And he still holds those. And I bet you they're still just as good as they always were because he covers a lot of very important stuff. If you can't handle the mental side of trading, no matter how smart you are at the rest of it, you'll screw it up. Mm-hmm. So he thought, all right, Tom's got this nice mellow, you know, he answers his questions with formulas and with numbers and their specific answers. Some of his previous model traders, like I replaced Ed Sequoida, you know, Ed would answer a question with another question, like, what's your, somebody, I remember seeing him, somebody I'll never forget asked, so when you get into a trade, what's your objective? And Ed would say, why do you ask? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not exactly, you know, it was helpful in an extent and it was funny, but I just go ahead and give him the answer. So it was a good working relationship. Eventually, I got so swamped after New Market Wizards, I could not keep up with it all. I just had to, you know, beg off of Tharp's conferences. But that day in New Jersey, Tharp was going to hold something. He calls up Jack, and who's over in New York, across the river, says, hey, you know, Tom's going to be attending my peak performance seminar. Tell you what, I'll let you come for free and you can meet him. Okay. So he comes. So the first day we're sitting there, and as it typically happens whenever I'm speaking anywhere, you go to break. I don't get a break. I'm surrounded by 10 people. Well, Jack is a star too. So he's surrounded by 10 people. So he's listening out of the corner of his ear to what I'm, you know, getting asked and answering. And he's doing the same thing over on his little circle. And we kind of scramble to go to the bathroom real quick and get the thing going again. And this happens every single break. And he keeps noticing how many people are around me, just peppering me with questions. And I have answers for them. So he eventually, I don't think he was planning on doing this at all. He apologizes at the morning break on Sunday. He says, "Tom, I don't know if you've heard this. I'm doing another book. It's going to be called New Market Wizards. And I'd like to interview you. If you could do anything for lunch?" No. Okay. So we went down to this little Korean restaurant. I'll never forget it. It was a dive. And he hauls out and he's apologizing. He's setting up the tape recorder. He says, "Do you mind if I record this?" "The hell no, no problem at all." So we go through an hour and I could tell that he wanted to, you know, keep talking and asking me questions for the next 2-3 hours. And he said, I'm looking at my watch and I'm going, "You know, Jack, I'm supposed to be the main speaker this afternoon. Tharp's going to wonder where I am if I'm not back there in 10 minutes. And we do have to walk down the street. And why don't we just give me a call and we'll just continue this over the phone. You can record it there." "Oh, okay." So we did that, followed up, did it. He writes it up, sends it to me FedEx and with a note, comes in at 11 o'clock in the morning, says, "Just review it. Let me know your comments. You get complete right to edit the whole thing." So I read it during lunch. I call him back at about 1 o'clock my time. It's only been in my hands like 2 hours. And I said, "Yeah, I've got this. I got the chapter. It was fun reading it. I read it during lunch. Do you have a copy where you can take down my comment?" And he says, "Yes." And I said, "Okay, flip to page 8. Down in the second paragraph, you've got a misspelled word in the second sentence. It's this instead of that." And he said, "Okay." And I could hear the paper was ruffling and he marks it. And he says, "What else?" I said, "That's it." He said, "That's it?" He said, "Yeah, that's it. I think you caught the rest of the interview beautifully. You, in some cases, transcribed a few things I said to make it even more understandable, better than probably I said it. But you caught exactly what I was trying to get across. I have no problems with the rest of it." Mm-hmm. And he, big pause. And he says, "Tom, this has been the freakiest chapter. I have no idea whether the editor will be putting it in the book, but I can tell you this, this was the easiest chapter for me to write. You ended up finding one spelling mistake and you didn't change another thing. I've had people refuse to do the chapter after being interviewed. They read it and they say, I don't want it published." Mm-hmm. "And I have to kill the whole chapter." I have other people that have taken what I've written, completely rewritten the chapter and sent it back and say, "We want it done this way." He said, "Your chapter is unaltered and it was so easy to run. I don't know if the editor is going to put it in, but I really had a good time meeting you and doing all this." So when he sends me my copy of the book, he writes in the front, "Out of all the traders I've interviewed, I'd probably most like to model myself after you," because I was so relaxed. And he's caffeinated and, you know, jacked up and unstressed. And so that was a fun experience for me. And of course, then I'm Mr. Serenity forever. And it was an interesting experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very important chapter, you know, for that reason. I mean, this is such a an endeavor that can really get your emotions going, can get the adrenaline going. And so that's a huge feat, in my opinion, to be able to keep yourself. And I'll ask you a little bit more about, you know, the specifics and things like that. You know, it's funny because we've interviewed other market wizards and even like a lot of the recent ones from the new book. And a lot of them say that about Jack, that he captures the essence of the conversation. Because that's what I always ask them. "Oh, were you pleased with the chapter?" And I guess that's part of, you know, what makes Jack so good is he really extrapolates what's important from the conversation. And so shout out to Jack. We've had him on too. JJ, when we had him on, you know, Tom's description of him being a caffeinated New Yorker, I think that probably still rings true to this day. What do you think, Craig?
It is. And those are the people that I grew up doing business with. So I miss that, right? So when there's a New Yorker and he's just buzzed, and I'm like, oh yeah, this is great, right? Yeah, we'll stay up all night and work. Yeah, sure. Like when I go to New York, I sleep 3 hours a night because I just get into it, you know. And but you know, after having a heart attack at 44, I've learned now to kind of chill.
Keep it even.
You know, the profits are better when you chill. It's just, you know, you're not forcing things.
Well, you know, not only the profits, in my mind, your life is better. Well-being.
Yeah, your life is better. You actually pay attention, like,
you know, the way I always put it, people would ask me this question over and over again. When you're even keeled and you take everything flat, how can you enjoy life? How can you enjoy going to a movie? Or how do you, if you're at a party or, you know, whatever. And I tell them, you know, you have the human ability to decide to become excited about something, emotional. You can get sad at a funeral. You can get happy when you see a comedy. You can go to a party and laugh and do whatever you want to do. But you can also choose to be in a different state. And your mental state that you want to be in is your choice. You have the ability to control what mental state you are in at any point in time if you work at it. I realize that people that haven't done it as long as I have would probably have a little bit more difficulty. But if I was sitting there over their shoulder talking to them through it and letting them get into mental states, I think I probably could help a lot of people just be even keeled during trading. And then the question is, do you want to ever get excited in trading? Well, probably not. Do you ever want to get excited if you're on a battlefield? Probably not. If you could figure out how to do it. You know, there's times when it's, you choose, you know, like if you're in a horror flick and you want to be horrified, you can choose to be horrified, or you can sit and withdraw yourself back and say, this is just a movie. I'm just going to sit here and enjoy it with my wife, but I'm not going to let it get to me or something like that. Well, then kind of, why did you waste the money?
Yeah.
The point is to be horrified. Exactly. So I think that's what people miss out on, the fact that you have a choice in your mental state. And I think a lot of people let their mental state go wherever it wants to go, and life just pushes them around.
Also, there is a misinformation about trading. See, I was on the institutional side and I was an order flow jockey. So I'm making markets, pushing order flow, having clients. I'm taught you let the phone ring more than once, you're fired. You're so replaceable. There's 30 speed dials on my phone. It would take nothing to replace you. I haven't, you know, didn't take a holiday since 95, right? So you go from that to retail trading. And, you know, my whole thing was, I was influenced by Solomon Brothers, Liar's Poker. You wake up every morning ready to bite the ass off a bear. Retail trading is not that. You have to be able to chill and see things, because you're not competing for order flow. You're, you know, making tactical decisions, and you have to be completely different. And I still remember reading, and by the way, this is so cool, reading about you back then and actually getting to speak to you now. It's well, you know, I got to speak to Linda Raschke. She's the reason I got a job. She gave me the idea from reading the book on how to like get a job by the exchange so you could work your way, weasel your way in. And that's what I did in Vancouver. So, you know, it's great to meet, you know, people who, you know, you read about, and, you know, they're this sort of like mythical figure, and then you finally get to meet them, you know. And I still remember when I went on Twitter and I said something to you and you responded, and I went, was it ever cool Tom Basso responded to me? And he said, you know, cause like, you know, your whole life is, you know, is your whole identity was the market, you know. I've been doing this since 93. So yeah, it's really
well, cool. You know, the nice thing about this enjoy the ride gig that I just set up the website, there's a story on that too, if you want to hear it. We're sitting at a pool in Malaga, Spain with my wife, and we're drinking Rosado, and it's a beautiful sunny day on a Sunday. And I'm going to go have a meeting with Lawrence Bensdorp the next day, who's a, you know, really good trader from the Trading Mastery School. He's a good guy to interview too. You probably should have him on someday. He and I do some seminars every now and again on trading, and he's a brilliant guy. And so I'm sitting there and I said, you know, Brenda, I've got this problem. I am trying to be helpful. I've been retired like, I don't know, 16, 15 years at that point. And I get 6 to 8 emails a day from traders. And the other day, two different traders from two different countries asked me exactly the same question. And it took me paragraphs to answer it. And I had to type those two sort of all over again because the second one came in and I'm just answering the question. And it's just a lot of keystrokes, a lot of wasted time. And it's kind of getting, I like helping people, but wouldn't it be nice to automate that somehow so I don't have to spend so much time doing it? And we kicked around a whole bunch of ideas. And then we decided whatever I did would have to be asynchronous because like this morning I was out planting three bushes in the front yard and running irrigation and all that. I came in, cleaned up and ready to go for this thing. But I enjoy being outside. I might have on a different day tomorrow, I might go out and play 18 holes of golf, then come in and do my trading. I do not sit here at the desk all day. And so asynchronous means I can answer the question when I want to do it. So if somebody sends me an email, I can answer it when I get around to it. Could be tomorrow. It works for me. I'm retired. And so we came up with the website, said, hey, if we could collect all of my knowledge base, my research papers, my interviews, the books I recommend, some videos that I produced, the two books that I wrote, if we could do a couple of webinars and record those and just be helpful, then traders can go to that website 24/7 around the world and they can look at all sorts of interesting information without me being involved in it. It just sits there being hosted by odoo.com and away we go. And so literally thousands and thousands of traders now have visited the site and have, you know, looked at my position sizing book and look, you know, read my interviews are all free there. That's like an entire, I don't know how many dozens of hours of interviews. I'll put this one up there if you guys will let me. And, you know, people can get a lot of information on background in trading and useful tips and tricks sometimes here and there. And so I'm helping a lot of people, but I don't have to answer all those emails anymore. Yeah. I still get a few emails, but now again, most of it's messages on Twitter or something. They're usually pretty easy. It's very rare for me to get a one that requires a, you know, massive answer. So that's been good. And meanwhile, the enjoy the ride pays for itself. I don't have to come out of my pocket to keep the website going. So everything's good.
Yeah. Go check out the website. I, you know, preparing for this podcast, I was looking through it. A great, great website. A lot of great interviews, you know, articles, et cetera. Tom, I was just thinking, man, you know, with you being, you know, so serene, you know, not riding the roller coaster of emotions. I feel like that's even a bigger feat, knowing that you're Italian. I feel like we're very emotional, passionate people by nature. I mean, what do you think? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think in general. And I think, I don't know. I mean, if you've ever been at a bus stop in, say, Florence or something, and it, right next to the bus stop will always be a little espresso shop. And so at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, people are like taking a transfer from another one bus to another. They rush into the espresso shop, they grab an espresso, they down it, and they go out and get into the next bus. I don't know if that has something to do with it or not, but I know when I was in my 20s and I was going through a pot or two of coffee a day, and I'm 6'3 and 205, so I can spread it over a lot of body, but man, I was wired. And I started becoming more aware of how much that was affecting me somewhere in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And I decided, you know, I'm just going to go decaf. And I was decaf for decades. Wow. Nowadays, I'll have like a glass of iced tea with lunch if I'm outside and, you know, it's a hot day and I'm with my wife and stuff. And I don't have anything particularly, I don't have intense trading that afternoon, or I don't have to try to, you know, do something that's potentially stressful. So it's no big deal to me now. I understand how the difference in how I feel. Sometimes I do it just to remind myself of the way I used to feel so that I caution myself and say, let's stay away from that. But that gave me a lot of peace and a little ability to pull back from a situation. I think discipline in trading and discipline in life really whether it be passing up the chocolate cake when you're on a diet or whether it be not doing a stupid trade because you shouldn't, it's not part of your strategy. It's you being aware that you're deviating from some plan or some objective that you're striving for, and then correcting yourself back to what you're supposed to be on that path. I think in trading, if you can be aware enough that anything that you're doing is either pushing your button and wanting you to be greedy, wanting you to be nervous, wanting you to be fearful, all those different types of emotions you go through. And then you say, okay, well, wait, it doesn't make any difference whether I'm excited, greedy, fearful, anything else. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. I've already got a trading plan. It says I should buy at a stop at this price, that many contracts, period. Just do it. And all of a sudden you're back on plan. And then you realize that you did the right thing. And at the end of the day, Tharp always says, and I totally agree with this, beautiful statement. What's a good day of trading? It's a trading day that you followed your plan. It's not whether you made money or lost money. It's whether you followed your plan. So I have a lot of good trading days because I've run 8 strategies now across, I don't know, probably right now I'm holding 50 instruments. A lot of it's automated, some of it isn't. But, you know, at the end of the day, when I get done with this interview, I'll go on, pull up my data and run through it. It'll take me about 30 minutes or so. I'll be all set for the next 24 hours after that. And tomorrow, who knows, I might be out golfing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, isn't that the great part about, you know, being a systemized trader? I think it can really help with the emotions and more just focus on the process. Hey, I made the right decisions. Hey, I followed the system. Whereas I think at least some of the people that me and JJ encounter, people who are very like highly discretional traders, is it can really mess with your mind. And it can be a lot of noise in between trades. And sometimes it's even hard, I think, to review your own trades if you're not at least somewhat systemized. Yeah, even if you are a discretionary trader, you would agree with that, Tom?
Yeah, I agree. Discretionary trading, the little bit that I've done over my years, was mostly done early in my career. And then I have done some in the last year or two simply to try to create enough experiences so that I could design a trading strategy that would capture those discretionary decisions.
Right.
Based on what I was looking at as a discretionary trader, how can I mathematically describe that to a spreadsheet or to a rule-based? You know, when I say a systems trader, you could go all the way to the computer, which is where Trendstat was. Some of the stuff I do is very, very rule-based, and there is no judgment whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it takes me 30 seconds to update that particular strategy because in many days I don't have anything to do. I look at the graph, I move a stop, I grab it with my cursor, move it up, I'm done. I move on to the next strategy. So, but it's rule-based. So you could say it's not computerized, but it's rule-based. Well, when it's rule-based and I know what those rules are, why I have them, how to size the positions, everything else is all cookbook, it takes very little time to execute it. The time I spend in trading nowadays might be some morning where I've got an idea. Somebody at one of the seminars asked me a good question and I didn't know the answer. And I thought, let's look into that. And I'll do some research. I'll get a spreadsheet going or I'll do some programming or whatever. And I'll test out some new theory or I'll try to get a trading platform to help me do that, whatever I can do to solve the problem. And in that case, I'm using my creative brain because execution, I don't know if JJ would agree, but when you're on a floor, let's say, and you've got order flow coming through, it's you are in the middle of the noise. Exactly. And there is really a mentality almost of execute, execute, execute. You just keep going. Yeah. You go fast. You don't think a lot. You just get it done.
Yep.
And the same is true if you're an off-the-floor trader like I always was. But if you're a discretionary off-the-floor trader, you have a whole lot of time on your hands to screw things up and to think of, well, maybe I ought to do this. Wow, look at that. That's interesting. You get distracted. You get emotional. It's so easy. And because you have all this time, especially when you're looking at me, I've got trades that I've been in for months now. and I'm still in on them. These are futures trades. Yeah. I mean, I'm not in there in the noise buying and selling all day long. So there's a lot of potential for the person to screw it up and to think too much, but rules-based keeps you in that sort of a tight plan that if you want to change it, you know, spend lots of time analyzing, thinking it through. If you want to change that tight plan, have a good reason to change it. I'm not saying I've never changed a plan or any of my strategies, but you have to have a real good reason to do that. And you better know what you're doing when you do that, because that's what you're going to run every day from there on in. And when you're actually running it, I mean, that's why I can do 8 strategies in like 30 minutes across 50 instruments, because it's very cookbooky. It's almost boring. I think when trading gets to the point where it's boring and it's just a money-making operation and it's something you do like brushing your teeth every day.
Yeah.
I think you've finally mastered it a little bit, you know, you don't have to get stressed out.
That's definitely the idea, right? JJ, you say that all the time.
Oh, geez, definitely. Good trading is, because I came from the institutional side and I was raised in the sort of cesspool of this penny stock world. That's where I came from. So, we had no discipline, right, at all. So, if I was retail trading in my own account and I took a loss, a market maker would put it up for me because I'm giving them so much order flow. They'd eat 10, 20 grand for me, no problem, right? So you have no discipline on using stops. So that was the biggest thing when I thought, oh, this retail trading, it'll be easy. Yeah, no big deal, right? But when you don't have the order flow, or you're not making the market, you're like, I got stopped. I'm not smart at all. and they're like, oh, discipline. Oh yeah, I've read about that. Maybe it's time I go get some.
they have some today on a special down at Walmart.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think a great book I've read recently by Daniel Kahneman, I believe is his name. He wrote the book Thinking Fast and Slow. He won a Nobel Peace Prize for his work in psychology. And his new book is called Noise. And I think it's highly applicable for traders to read. I suggest for all the listeners to read it. And, you know, Tom, he was saying how just having like for people who were in predictive fields. Prognostication. There it is. Thank you, Tom.
That's a multi-syllable word.
Prognostication. So people in prognostication fields, it depends on what you're prognosticating, but oftentimes, and they've done extensive studies on this, that just having simple rules beats having complex rules. Now, when you're dealing with certain things, having a system with, a lot of different inputs is going to be better than just having simplistic rules. But for things like trading and similar things, just having very simple rule-based. So it was just cool to see what things like, people like yourself have been saying for a long time, for it to be backed up by, academia. So,
if you really look at something simple like the SPY, back when I did the study on this back in 2003, just before we shut down Trendstat, we were trying to get into some automated day trading. Mm-hmm. So I had one of the guys on the computer capture a stream of SPY ticks coming in off the satellite up above my roof. We were measuring 32 to 34 different ticks per second.
Wow.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Now, talk about liquidity. Because some of these are 10,000 share blocks, and you're talking about billions and billions of nowadays, a couple hundred million shares traded, and really billions in terms of value. So when you have that kind of noise coming through, that beyond what the human brain can't even see, the 32 times a second, I mean, your screen would just be blinking. Mm-hmm. And 20 times a second, it would be a blur. 32, it's probably more than that now. This is back in 2003. So what you got to do as a human being, you have a limitation on how much you can derive information and make decisions on noise. And by having some rules that allow you to compress noise into information and say, I'm going to ignore everything from this point to this point. I'm going to dictate that that's noise. But if it gets above this point, I'm going to call it a bull market. If it gets below that point, I'm going to call it a bear market and go short, or I'm going to go get out and go to cash. By having some decisions and allowing yourself to get rid of a lot of the noise, you can then step back and, as a human being, make logical, simple decisions and not have to make them like second by second.
Yeah. Yeah. I love what you said too. Yeah. Recognizing the limitations of our brain. And that's huge, because I think
Clint Eastwood, man's got to know his limitations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Clint Eastwood.
It's huge. Tom, I want to read a quote from the section of the Market Wizards and just kind of, you know, just talk to it. Yeah, the quote is, it's psychologically comforting to construct a system that looks very good in its past performance. Doing that, you can have conditions that are unrealistically restrictive. And then you go on this to say how you try and keep the model as flexible as possible. How does one leave flexibility in their models?
All right. Thanks to Jack Schwager on this one. Jack always used a term with me he called degrees of restriction. Mm-hmm. So let's make a simple example. If we were to, at the end of every day, flip a coin, heads, we went long SPYs. We then trailed it with a 2x average true range stop loss point. And we trailed it and moved it up. If we bought it and the market went our way, we'll just keep trailing the stop and we make a bunch of money on the trend. If it goes against us and hits the stop, we stop out. And the next afternoon, we flip the coin again. If it's tails, we're going to go short and we'll put the stop 2 ATRs above. Now, every time we get a major move, we're going to make money. Every time it doesn't go anywhere, we're going to lose, but we're going to lose very little because our stop is tight. So it's going to be let your gains run, cut your losses short. How many variables are in that strategy? There would be the flip of the coin. That's one variable, because that's going to either go heads or tails. That's one. And the second one is going to be where we place the stop. And we've got an ATR, average true range. So we have to pick a number of days. So let's say 21 days. That's one variable. So now we're up to two. Right, we got the heads and tails, and we got the 21 days for the ATR, and we got a 2.0 times the ATR stop, so that would be a third factor in the whole system. So you got three numbers or items that are going to be into that entire strategy. That strategy would tend to make a small amount of profit over a very long period of time, it turns out. I wouldn't trade it because it's a flip of a coin. I mean, come on, we could do better than that, we think. Mm-hmm. However, it points to the fact that if you keep something very simplistic and just run it mindlessly, the computer would say that you probably are going to eke out a profit over the long run. Now let's examine what happened to one of my partners back in the old days at the registered investment advisory firm before I sold and got out. I come back from a trip and I was talking to clients and all that. And I said, hey, are we long the mutual funds? Because we were timing mutual funds. And he had taken this book and he had written down the simple strategy. And then he found that if we added this filter to the strategy, that would be better. And then if this happens, that happens. And he's got all these rules. And he's just writing pages now. And he says, no, we're not long. And I said, huh, I thought we would have been long. Get your book out. So he starts going through and he says, okay, well, first you get this indicator. And I said, okay, yeah, and that's in our favor. And then you do this filter. And I said, I would have thought the filter would be giving you the buy signal too. And he looked at it and says, yeah. And then we flip the page. And then he says, now you look at this. And he goes and page after page. And we get down to the last item. And he says, and then this. And I said, so doesn't that mean we should be long now? And he says, oh, crap, I missed the trade. It was so complicated, he couldn't execute it, okay? Now, what that is an example is the opposite extreme. Instead of three, we've got so many different variables over so many different time periods, so many different instruments. Have the market's got to agree to buy this mutual fund. You got to have the S&P doing that. Oh my gosh, you got to have interest rates going down. Oh my goodness. You get all that done, you'll be hard pressed to even have a trade, even if you could figure out how to do it, because to have all those conditions come to pass might be once every 10 years. I mean, you might have 100% reliability, but you'll never do a trade. That's useless. It's too restrictive. And so Jack coined the term degrees of restriction, because the more variables you have in a trading strategy, the more restrictive it is in being able to react to the world around us, because the world's always changing. You'll never see a one-day crash of 1987, October 19th again, 23% down in one day or whatever it was. You know, that was a unique one day, and it happened, and it's in the historical databases. And if you ran simulations through that day, you would get whatever you would get, but you're never going to get exactly that same thing again. There wasn't as many computers back then as there are now.
Yeah.
Flash crashes could be far more severe than they used to be. Now we have circuit breakers kicking in. There's all sorts of other weird stuff that constantly is changing. So, you know, in terms of fighting the battles, you don't want to be fighting the last battle. You want to be fighting the next one. So you got to keep yourself flexible and think outside the box and keep things, realize that you don't have to fine tune a simulation to the 10th of a decimal point. It'd be better to just understand roughly what you're going after and capture the lion's share of that big move coming up, and not worry about whether you got in today or tomorrow. If you're getting in on a move that's going the next 3 months, you don't have to worry about whether you get in exactly now or 2 hours later. It's not that big of an important thing, because the lion's share of the profit's going to be made over the next 3 months.
Yeah.
So that's what people miss, I think. They want to, everybody obsesses over buy or sell engines to the point where they're trying to make them perfect. You know, I want to make sure every trade's profitable if I could do it. You don't have to be. I mean, over my lifetime, I was probably 33% reliable, but yeah, profitable. 2/3 of my trades were losers over my lifetime.
Yeah.
And that's what you people need to understand that.
And that's all you need. Yeah, it's funny, Tom. I mean, we're in episode 70. We've talked to a lot of traders and a lot of world-class traders, and so many of them echo that as well, is that, like, I don't even win most of my trades. I win 25% of my trades. I win 30% of my trades, you know? But that's hard for, I think, people to wrap their brains around. It's very counterintuitive.
But the marketing.
Yeah.
The marketing done to the retail trading mindset, sure, gives the impression that you're not supposed to take losses. But if anybody who's actually worked in the business, right? I mean, if you look at some of the marketing, I mean, I have to say it because it'd be irresponsible not to, you know, oh yeah, you know, three easy setups and look at me and my Ferrari, you know? So it's, you know, people have unrealistic expectations, and a lot of people will think though, like, oh yeah, trading is what is it? It's passive income. I'm like, no. This is some of the hardest money you're ever going to work for, right? You have no idea how hard this is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, and I come from both sides of the street where I had 300 million shares to move, create a market, sell it into, I'd build the chart. You know, I went from making candles to now trying to figure out what the heck this means, right? And, you know, that's why I'm a market profile guy with Jim Dalton. I mean, I just, yeah, you know, I saw that and I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, he's like, you know, the guys who taught me. So, you know, he's like, you know, that ex-Marine, you know, tough and, you know, like, listen, you know, this is what you do. And so I fell into that. And thank goodness, because, yeah, it's really misconstrued, you know.
Yeah. A lot of floor traders, I think, over time, love the market profile stuff because it gets into levels. And that's way the floor trader tends to think.
And you can see the inventory. Right.
Yeah.
We're all about inventory, right?
Yeah.
You know,
I never was on the floor in my life except as a tourist. So I think I was on the Merck floor one time, you know, one of the conferences up in Chicago, and it was fun. You know, I did the mock trading thing. I sucked at it. I had no idea what I was doing. Well, and, you know, for me, I'm a data cruncher for the computer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you were talking about, you were, if you didn't answer the phone call in one trade, you're going to be fired, replaced.
Yeah, the first
you are ring. Replaced now. Yeah. It's all computerized.
Oh, there's no floors. I know.
I sit here. I remember back when I first started in futures, I'd call Heinold, if you remember them back in the old days, and I call my broker there. He puts it to a back cage. The cage teletypes it. The teletype gives it to a runner. The runner takes it out, hands it to the guy in the pit. The guy in the pit does his fancy hand signals.
Yeah.
He writes it up to some other guy on the other side of the pit and hope they got their badges right, drops it on the floor. Somebody crawls on the floor, gets the ticket, takes it back to the person on the edge of the pits who has to teletype it back to St. Louis back in those days. Wow. And then I get a call from my broker about a half an hour later saying, I filled this one corn contract. Nowadays, I turn over here to my other screen and I hit a couple mouse clicks. Yeah. And by about the time I have turned my head to go back to my emails, I get a blip and it's already confirmed over here.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, I was starting just when the floors were ending, and I was one of the guys who I was on a Canadian desk trading U.S. order flow. So that was my thing. And it was all dealing with the wholesalers out of Jersey City, of the time. And, it was a great experience, but it completely not what, you know, retail trading and doing that is, and being, and managing portfolios. Like, I'm doing a thing now where I'm trying to teach people how to swing trade using profile. And, you know, I'm in a trade and I'm swinging the thing. And if I have to hold something for more than 40 seconds, I'm getting itchy. I'm like, I feel like, what am I, Warren Buffett? What is this? You know, it's like, I got to hold it overnight. Ugh.
You need to go on blood pressure medicine or something.
I know. It's like, I have trouble holding stock when it's given to me for free, let alone when I pay for it.
Well, and I maintain, you know, if you look at a lot of people ask me, I get all these strange questions from people, but do you think volatility has gotten greater? And I said, oh yeah, it sure has. But it's totally normal, because if you think about like 1973, 74, which may be earlier than both of you, I think, at your ages, but I'm 69 the other day, so I remember it vividly. 73, 74, the Standard & Poor's 500 was down 50% over those 2 years. So it took 2 years to do that. Well, in 2008, we were down 50%. How long did it take to do it then?
Yeah.
A year, nine months, I don't know, something like that. How about the COVID crash? Was it 35% in about six weeks? Months.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Why is that? Well, because we can trade 1 billion shares of stock through the exchanges now. When the end of 74, I vividly remember I get the Wall Street Journal, and if they did 10 million, it was black headlines that the New York Stock Exchange hits 10 million. I mean, they were breaking open the champagne, the floor traders, for handling 10 million shares. Now we do 1 billion a day, and it's they don't blink. And so when you do that, you're compressing time periods down and executing the same psychological profile. From euphoria at the high to depression at the low, you're doing it in 6 weeks instead of 2 years, because you're not doing all this stuff by hand anymore. People want to make a trade. They just turn to the computer. They make it. Yeah. They go through all the same emotions they used to go through. They're just doing it at like 10 times or 100 times the speed that they used to. So it looks like it's more volatile, and I suppose mathematically it is, but the same things are happening. They're just happening in different time periods.
Do you, quick question.
Yeah.
For, you know, swing trading, how are you finding swing trading in this crazy market where the selling just shuts off and it's not really that liquid, because you see, you know, look at the positions like Apple and things like that. They're warehoused by these money managers. So,
well, swing trading encompasses to me a fair variety of different ways that you could go about that. Okay. If you were trying to swing trade and actually do what I would call more of a mean reversion swing trade, where you're trying to pick, say in your case, market profile levels, and you're going to say, when it gets up to here, I'm going to sell it at a limit. I'm going to buy it at a limit down at the low part of the range, or vice versa, buy it low, sell it high, whatever. That's one way of sort of thinking through swing trading. You could also do it with price resistance levels, anything from Gans, Fibonacci's, just based, just X's and O's, point and figure charts. You could do a lot of different ways to find those levels, high and low, mm-hmm. and you're trying to just pick up the difference. Another approach to swing trading could be what I would call very short-term trend following. So what you do there is you'd set up an overbought, oversold indicator like a stochastic or an oscillator of some sort, RSI stochastic, things like that. And you would measure whether the market or that instrument was overbought or oversold. Let me get rid of this. Excuse me for that. And what you could do is from that oversold position, you know the market is now oversold, you could set up a very, very short-term trigger that would be a trend following model. So you could actually buy on a stop as it comes out of that oversold position and then try to pick up the swing that way. You might not be picking up the extremes of the swing, but you'd be picking up the middle part of the swing with a trend following model. And you'd have the odds a little bit more on your side from the overbought, oversold condition. And you'd have a very handy stop to put in if it just continued to go through your level and go against you. So you could take a small loss, try to get a multiple R trade, you know, maybe make two or three times what your average loss is. And you could probably get your reliabilities up in the, you know, maybe 40, maybe even 50 if you somehow figured that out. But I wouldn't think you'd get it too much higher than that, statistically speaking. But that's another viable way. Yeah. And for me as a trend follower that I've been all my life, that type of swing trading is much more comfortable to me because I understand trend following and it's my mentality. Trying to put a limit out in the middle of some place and watching the price come to my limit and just go right through it and keep going.
Oh, yeah.
That's just not my thing. I have a hard time mentally with that one, but.
And with these ranges, you know, there's enough meat on the bone in between the high and the low.
With the volatility being so much more, you know, over such a smaller time period, as long as you can measure the overbought, oversold condition over the shorter term time frame, and then set up a sort of a quick trend following. I mean, I might be in a position, I got one where if I'm sitting here at the desk all day, I'm trading intraday using 5-minute bars, and I do it while I'm working. It takes me a glance once every 5 minutes over to the chart, moving, you know, with my cursor, and then I'm done, and I go back to work for another 5 minutes. And I'm probably running about 50, maybe 52% reliable on it. It doesn't make, you know, enough money to make a difference in my life. It helps the portfolio when I do it. But I don't change my plans. If I feel like golfing, I'd rather go play golf than make a couple $1,000 over here on the screen. It's not worth my time.
You know, what we do is with our folks is we trade them. We first teach them to trade for income. So that's a wonderful thing that you're, you know, we really thank you for that.
The shorter the time frame, the lower the risk usually is to your stop losses. And I think a lot of smaller portfolios traders starting out, if they have the time and if they have the mentality and want to try to do it, if they can stick to the shorter term, that helps them be able to put a position on and still control the risk. Doing what I do over some periods where I'm holding positions for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 2 years, some cases, that's going to have a bigger risk per unit. And therefore, I'm going to have a smaller position to cover that risk. I don't want my risk to get big, just like everybody. I mean, I want to keep my risk under control. So I'm going to have a smaller position, but because I have a larger portfolio than a lot of people, it still is fine with me. And I'm retired. So I'm not looking to, you know, I think last year I did over 100% return. That was completely by accident, thanks to COVID. It had nothing to do with me trying to push the envelope. And I mean, I caught the downswing in COVID. I caught the upswing in COVID recovery, and both sides were extremely profitable, and it all compounded. This year and most year, that was the best year of my life. And I wouldn't be surprised if I never see that return again. Wow. I'm happy with a 10% year. It's okay for me. It doesn't change my life.
Isn't that kind of how, I guess kind of like speaking to trading and even individual trades, Tom, sometimes like the best ones are, just following your system. It's not like you planned on making 100%, right? It just, you stuck to your rules, you stuck to your system, and it just worked out that way.
And, you know, a lot of CTAs last year, I've heard through the grapevine, got into the COVID crash, maybe had a little bit of a drawdown or made a ton of money even. And then they got down to the bottom and they say, oh my God, the world's ending. You know, this whole thing is insane. And now we're, you know, we're locking down the economy. We're doing all this stuff. I'm just going to discretionarily step in and forget all my rules and not follow anything and just go to cash. And they missed the entire upswing.
Yeah.
Because they were sitting there waiting for the W bottom. We're going to test the bottom sometime. No, it didn't test, did it? It just went straight up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just followed my strategy and it hit the crazy buy signal. And I said, okay, here we go. This will be fun. And it ended up being insanely profitable. And wow. All I did was just the same thing I'm going to do this afternoon after this interview. Just going to sit down with my data, go through my 30 minutes, do the same exact thing I always do.
Yeah.
And I think when people let their emotions override what is a well-oiled plan, it's just, it's lots of ways it can go bad. And then what are you doing? Then you're kicking yourself. Then you're saying, mm-hmm. Oh God, I missed it. Or if you're a CTA, your clients are saying, how come we're missing it? Exactly. And they're all over your back. And oh my God, that's a terrible road to go down.
Terrible. I remember during this time, JZ, I remember as talking with you, I was talking with Steve as well. Shout out to Steve. He's at Beyond the Trades. During that whole move, we're like, man, like people sitting on the sidelines, you're missing this whole, you know, just see,
oh, yeah.
You know, what a time to miss, you know, and then you're kicking yourselves afterwards. And I feel like that's even worse of an emotion to even deal with.
Definitely.
But you know,
I mean, yeah, we started, I remember after that big move up, and it started moving up, the 13F started coming out. And I told one of my buddies, go check the 13Fs and see if these, you know, these Mastodon type money managers came out of any paper, right? Because that's my whole thing is supply, right? Where's the supply? Yeah. Oh, it's still locked up. BlackRock didn't sell any. They sold 10 million shares of Apple. Big deal. Get on the bid, right? Yeah. You know, it's like, because these guys are warehousing stock. I mean, I kind of picture BlackRock where you have all these stock certificates in a crypt, you know, covered with about 6 inches of dust, you know?
And, you know, they would be the market. They are not,
you know,
they are not investing or trading in the market.
No,
they
exactly. Are the market. Exactly. Right. $9 trillion.
That's that's insane. I have a hard time getting my head around that. That's a too many zeros.
And their Aladdin algorithm thing is, you know, it's that whole server farm is in some apple orchard in Wenatchee, Washington. You know, which is the most, I've been there. It's the most unlikely place that you'd ever think, you know. Interesting, yeah. Fascinating company.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. Tom, they got to do what they do. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned you're 69 years old. What's the secret, man? Good diet, exercise. Is that wine you're making? Well, what is it?
It's a combination of a lot of things, I would say. It's keeping your stress levels down and being even killed like I am. Mm-hmm. I think being happy and having a good life gives you something to look forward to every day when you wake up. I'm always excited to wake up. Today my job was pulling out some roots from an old bush that I was taking out and putting in three new bushes in the place of that. And I've really dressed up my front here at the mountain home in Arizona. But I'm looking forward to that when I wake up. That's one thing. The second thing is I make sure my nutrients, I've been keto for about 6 years now, lost 20 pounds, work out, you know, mostly cardio stuff. A lot of stuff I'll do in the pool. I love pool cardio because you're pushing against water and it's very forgiving to your muscles. So you don't get the soreness the next day you get from lifting weights. So that's kind of fun. I think that's, you know, enjoying golf, but walking the golf course instead of riding if I can. So in the valley where I golf, I always walk and push my cart. Diet with the keto means I'm a little higher on fat. I have enough protein to feed my muscles and I keep down on the carbs. My blood sugars come in extremely normal. My cholesterol is below 200. If I have fat, it's stuff like olive oil, virgin olive oil. So it's healthy fat for you, monosaturated fat. So those are good things. take a few life extension type pills, give a little ad to life extension. So lifeextension.com, you can see a lot of very helpful nutrients. So if you get a blood test on your micronutrients and you feel like you're down in anything, for example, COVID supposedly doesn't do well if you have a very high vitamin D level, but you can overdose on vitamin D. So you don't want to have too much. So you want to have enough, but you don't want to have too much. Well, we did a blood test and I was a little low in vitamin D. So we've bumped up a little vitamin D3 tablets that I take every morning to get my immunity system up as high as I can. So things like that, just making some intelligent decisions and being a little disciplined. You know, wine has flavonoids, I think it is, and that's supposed to be good for you. And I enjoy my wine, but I don't try to overdo it. During the week, usually I rarely drink any alcohol, but Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you know, it's the weekend. I relax and go to parties and have fun and invite people over for dinners and we have a good time. Awesome. So those things all lead to together to a sort of a, I don't know, an enthusiasm for life. And I think it keeps you young, keeps you striving to get through another day and enjoying the day and taking enjoyment in meeting people and, you know, things like this. I two new friends over the web here and a whole bunch of other people that'll probably watch this. So just kind of fun. Try to make life fun. Don't make it a drudgery. Don't sit there and do things that you don't want to do every day.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I've always been a believer too, Tom, that the, you know, it's a whole, you know, with trading, like a lot of times people think you can just turn your you can be undisciplined in your everyday life and then just automatically maybe discipline in your trading. I don't really think there's a distinction. And so bringing that respect for your life and your health, et cetera, that will translate over into your trading. And I know JJ, you started keto, what, about a year ago, and you've seen good results as well, right?
Yeah. I my girlfriend put me on this thing and,
She's didn't have any choice in it.
No. I mean, well, she's an anesthesiologist and she's an MD PhD and I'm just, you know, a poke them in the eye, you know, trader. So, that's my education, poke them in the eye and hit the bid. That's all I know. So, you know, she put me on this and I feel great. You know, it's really, you know, your blood sugar is down, especially me, because I had a quintuple bypass, you know.
Yeah.
At 44. So,
yeah,
you know, that's, you know, which is, you know, when you're working for people who, you know, expect you to, you know, be on call 24 hours a day and, you know, yeah, they're beck and call and
tell me about it. I traded, you know, currencies.
Oh God,
Forex that trades.
So what, you had a computer next to you? Did you have one next to your a screen next to your bed or?
No, I didn't. But I've heard of guys that were in the business with me that did have screens down on the floor next to their bed.
Yeah.
And they'd have it on and they'd wake up at 2 o'clock to go to the bathroom and they'd see what the Deutschmarks were doing or whatever. No. I would get, if my head trader George was out on a Sunday night frequently, usually with a brand new newbie on the desk in Japan, I would get a call something like, "Ah, Mr. Basso, your stop order on Deutschmarks 1.2356. Do you want us to fill when it hits that or when the ask is at it?" And I would say, just if it trades there, do it.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make any difference. And I think they just wanted to see if they could call me and talk to me or something. But for me, it'd be like 2 o'clock my night.
It's wake them up.
Why are you calling me? I was asleep. But you know, I don't have that anymore.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's I only trade the E-mini, and I find it relaxing trading it after, you know, making markets in NASDAQ stocks.
Yeah,
for hedge fund,
I would think it'd be a lot easier.
It's like, oh yeah.
Yeah,
that was pretty good imitation there, Tom.
That
was fairly good.
It happened enough to where I could remember the voice and the inflections and stuff.
And when you were talking that, my head immediately went to the first chapter of Victor Niederhofer's book, The Old Man and the Yen. I don't know if you've read that chapter, but I love that chapter of his book, and he's, you know,
he's trading currencies and he hasn't slept in 3 days, and you know, and he's down, and you know, and his CD player is broken, but he's too cheap to buy a new CD player because he's down in the position, you know, even though it's just like $50. It's just like,
I mean, Friday afternoon, New York would like us to get the orders in maybe a little early. So we'd run them maybe out here in Arizona. We'd run it maybe 12:30, 1 o'clock. And I would be on the golf course up in the mountains, an hour and a half away by 3:00.
Nice.
Playing 9 holes before dinner. Oh, we would, you know, when we shut down, we pretty much for the weekend, Sunday night would come in and everything would start all over again in Japan.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tom. I got a few more questions for you.
Yeah, no worries.
I feel like we could talk to you, you know, all evening here. I don't want to keep you too long. Another part of the Market Wizard section that struck out to me when you were talking about the observer, you know, observing yourself from the outside. It's really the first thing that struck me. That's really like a Buddhist type teaching. Is that something that was influencer you, or these principles were just something that kind of you've naturally stumbled upon?
No, I stumbled on it in high school initially because I was a nerd beyond belief. I love Star Trek. You know, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. I loved engineering. I loved math. I loved chemistry. I loved physics. So came time to get up in front of an English class of about 20 people, most of whom I had gone to school with most of my life. I knew them that long. And they had to get up and do their book report just like I did. And my hands were shaking. I could hardly function. Mm-hmm. And I went home that night and I was just, you know, rattled and kind of just, you know, just disappointed in myself and embarrassed and, you know, all the different emotional things. And I kept playing back the tape in my brain of what it looked like for me to look out into the classroom and what it looked like for me to look down and see my hand shaking, holding the piece of paper that I was reading from. And so there was this sort of feedback about, that's not a good thing. Why am I doing that? So that was not real time. That was playing it back at night after the whole day. And I started from that point on sort of playing back a tape of the day late at night, or I guess I'm going to bed or something. I'd say, okay, what happened today significant? And what did that feel like? What did it look like? What could I have done better? You know, there was this kind of feedback loop going on. Well, as I got into playing basketball in college, I was calling out defenses for a 2-on-2 matching zone. And I was in the back right side. And so I'm yelling out, hey, Gary, there's a guy behind you. Barry, watch it to your left. You know, Durf, go out and get the guy in the corner. And I'll, you know, and I'm slipping in behind him to feed the zone. And so I'm yelling that out. I've got to keep track real time of people going behind me because I don't have anybody calling out for me. I'm back at the baseline. So they're sneaking around behind me or they're hanging out back there. And I know they came in one side, out of one side of my vision. They didn't come out the other side. So they're still back there. I'm keeping track of all this real time. And I'm starting to, at that point, get a little bit more real time observer self. Mm-hmm. So there's the part of my brain that now has to, as an observer, watch Tom do what he does. And there's the other part that actually has to get Tom to do what he does. So, for example, I'll do it in front of the screen here. Part of my brain can say, this would be great to emphasize this point, to use my Italian hands and talk with my hands like I usually do. Or, you know, you're overdoing that, Tom. Just keep your hands sort of like together like that, and it looks more peaceful. You're a little less excited looking. You look more like Mr. Serenity. So one part of my brain is looking at what do I look like? And then the other part of my brain's actually carrying on the conversation with you. Mm-hmm. And it sounds, I don't know, psychotic or something, but really what ends up happening is very useful because if you can see yourself doing what you do, you can do all sorts of things like avoid that chocolate cake when you're on a keto diet, because you see yourself wanting to go and grab that piece of cake and the observer self says, wait a second, that's not with the program. What are you doing? You know, mm-hmm. and letting you see that stuff. Or, hey, that's not part of your trading strategy. What the heck are you doing?
Yeah.
And so it's very useful. And I'd say now the observer self is no longer an observer self. It's sort of like an awareness level. I used to think of it as two parts of my brain keeping track of what I was doing. One part keeping track and the other part doing it. Now it's sort of like just an awareness that's there all the time. I've done it for so many years. It's real time. And it's just, unless I'm highly caffeinated or have had too much to drink, like wine wise or something, I just have that awareness going all the time. I'd have to chemically knock out my awareness with, you know, anesthetics, or, you know, if I'm going into a surgery, or it'd have to be something artificial to knock that guy out. Otherwise he's there all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've definitely been, I definitely probably talk with my hands a little bit too much. I have a little bit of an excitable nature. But no, that was funny. That was making me laugh, Tom. That's great.
Sometimes it's good to emphasize a point.
It is. Yeah. You know, because I'm that observer self, that's what really struck me is like, man, like maybe being like one of the keys to like your success. I think that's huge. And for you to just stumble upon that like early on. I mean, obviously, there's probably other things as well, but that's probably a huge component of it. Because I think most people, I know it's hard for me, and it's something I've really had to practice, just bringing that awareness, or just like learning ourselves and like stepping back and seeing how we make decisions, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So
I can't remember the name of the book, but I think I read a book somewhere along the way. I started feeling like observing myself, and somewhere along the way, I think I found a book on observing self or something. I can't remember, and I don't remember the author or the name of the book, but you might do some searches on the term observer self, and there you may get some ideas there.
Absolutely. Great. All right.
Yeah, it just moves you along the path a little quicker. But in moving along the path, it was just sort of an evolution. And I would say by the time I was probably 28 to 30 years old, I was pretty much doing it all the time.
Yeah. Awesome. Tom, well, do you have any thoughts around cryptocurrency? Has this been something you've looked into? Yeah.
Yeah, I've looked into it a little bit, and I certainly don't think it's ready for prime time as much as some people do. I don't think it's, for starters, a currency. I don't think at all that it'll ever, short-term wise, be used to, and I remember saying this during one of the seminars, my wife said, oh, you got to use that line again. So thank you, Brenda, for reminding me to do that. If you go to the produce section of the grocery store and you buy a bunch of Brussels sprouts and you walk from there straight to the cashier, the price of those Brussels sprouts would have changed dramatically if you're buying them in Bitcoin. So you're not going to be able to, how the heck is the grocery store ever going to be able to price their products if they expect you to pay for them in, you know, Bitcoin somehow? I mean, you do it in dollars maybe, and then translate it to paying it in Bitcoin. I don't know, but it's just not ready for prime time there. It's got to be a lot more stable than it is. Secondly, the whole sort of cost of transaction, the bid-ask spreads are fairly significant, and the cost of doing some of the trades are significant enough to where, yes, there's enough movement to make a lot of money despite those costs. And I'm in on a trade on the future side, which is the way I would play it. I use the micro futures on the CME, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. They have a Bitcoin future, and they also have a micro Bitcoin future. Mm-hmm. So you can dial it in at a fairly small level. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a gazillionaire. And I think I'm in at, 34,000 something. And it's up in the 47s now. So I'm doing nicely on the trade, and I'm moving up my stops. My stops are at a profit now. But I have no idea whether those stops will be respected at whatsoever. I have no idea what kind of fill I'm going to get. Exactly. Good news and bad news is if it goes to 100,000, it won't change my life. And if it goes to zero, it won't change my life. So it's a nice experiment, and I'm getting some education in how the futures on Bitcoin does. But I don't, you know, it's obviously got the volatility to be profitable trading it. So I look at it as a trading instrument only. Yep. It's no different than buy and sell in gold, silver, mm-hmm. live cattle, or anything else out there. You know, euros. It goes up, it goes down. You can buy it, sell it. I don't think it has any intrinsic value. For those folks who think it's going to be the inflation hedge of the next century, my answer to that would be, is it will if everybody treats it that way. Right. And if they don't, it won't. Right. You know, mm-hmm. gold could be an inflation hedge. Bitcoin could be an inflation hedge, or toilet paper could be an inflation hedge. They all have sort of equal probability of possibly being an inflation hedge. I just don't see, you know, it's gone a long ways towards getting to where it needs to be, but I think it's got a lot of distance to go to really become what we pay for the groceries with.
Yep. And what did you kind of think of earlier this year when we saw the whole, you know, like GameStop, AMC, like the really, you know, heavy like retail activity, you know, going bonkers? What were your thoughts?
My initial reaction to that was, if I was back in the business still, the SEC, if I had done that to those stocks, would probably be investigating me the next day. That it smacks of just, I don't know, stock manipulation. It's crazy.
It does. I have to agree.
What?
Because back in the old days, my clients would go, "Hey kid, you know, because we used to do things like direct mail to entice people to buy stocks, and faxing and all of that stuff."
I probably received some of your letters.
Oh dear God, you probably did. We got one of Jack Schwager's guys pretty good. But the thing is, I swear to God, we used to think of these mechanisms to bring retail in where you'd actually have so much retail buying, you'd run out of stock to sell, right? And when I saw that, and I'd say, this thing's trading like $8 billion worth of paper a day. You know, I could come into that market, take 30% of that, and nobody would even know I was there. You know, if you were a net seller, you know, if you had a position, these guys, I don't know, somebody made a lot of money on those deals.
Yeah, they do. But I thought stock manipulation was sort of frowned on by the SEC. I don't know.
Maybe I don't
not
know
so much anymore.
Maybe they're on holiday, or they're all trying to get.
Kill the shorts. Let's all get together and collude with each other, and then kill these other guys over here, and we'll have a battle and see who wins.
Well,
I don't know. It seems a little.
I don't know. Shorting's not as much fun. I mean, ever since they introduced Reg Sho in 2005, shorting's not nearly as much fun as it used to be.
Yeah. Well, so I guess probably the problem with this whole thing with SEC is like who do they pin down? Like, there's not like just one person. It's like a forum of people. Exactly. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
a brilliant way to get around the rules.
I'm sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. It's like when those old spy movies where they route the phone call between 20, 30 different countries.
Yeah.
Right. Good luck trying to trace it. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
didn't trade in it. I did have a friend who was running a purely completely computerized. I mean, he literally, the run starts without him even pushing a button. It starts automatically based on a time clock. He was running, and he got some GameStop that came into some of his momentum models that were trend following. Obviously, GameStop had the momentum. It was like probably number one in momentum in the whole place with all the hundreds of percent. So he gets a signal. He goes in on it. He trails it with a stop. He has no clue. He might not even know he owned it for a few days. And then he saw all this news on it, and he's looking at its returns. The returns are pretty good. So he drilled down into the positions. And he got, oh, crap, I own this stuff. I mean, that's... So even system traders could get out on the action, and you wouldn't, you know, not necessarily, you're following your strategy, you're doing your thing, but, you're just going along for the ride. And it turns out all this outside motivation and manipulation is going on to try to make it happen. I don't know. Yeah. Kind of strange. I didn't get into AMC or GameStop, and don't care one way or the other.
Right. Yeah. Neither did I. No, that must've been a pleasant surprise though, for your friend. Looking at it. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of helped make his year. It was a good push to the portfolio.
I'm sure. Tom, you're the author of two books, Panic Proof Investing, and then you self-published one, the Frustrated
Investor. No, I actually had another one. Frustrated Investor, it turns out, is my version, self-published, of Panic Proof Investing. So when Wiley and Sons did the contract with me, they wanted me to add one more chapter, which I did, and then we added an appendix and we embellished a few things. And for some reason they wanted to call it Panic Proof Investing. I thought Frustrated Investor was a whole lot better title, but it was their publisher and editors that decided to do that. So that was more for retail investors that are hiring money managers or going and buying mutual funds or working with their stockbrokers, trying to understand what constitutes the investing process, what makes sense to keep you out of arbitration with your broker, and all that stuff. I've been witnesses in arbitrations and nobody has any fun. The broker doesn't have fun and the clients that got scammed or manipulated don't have fun either. A lot of money wasted, time wasted, a lot of angst. You don't need to do that if you pay attention to setting things up correctly. So I tried to write that book to help the retail investors. The second book was one I did more recently, and my wife had she had some injury to her shoulder when she was golfing, so her left shoulder. She had to have surgery, so she was in rehab, had to go to rehab a couple times a week, and I had to take her because she couldn't drive. She only got one hand. One arm. And so I decided to write a book on how to size positions. So I called it Successful Traders Size Their Positions, Why and How. And so I actually went back to the Trendstat actual algorithms that we used at Trendstat to size all of our futures and mutual fund positions, gave examples, gave the exact math we used. It's only about 80 pages. You can download it from the Enjoy the Ride world, or it's available on in various formats at Amazon and iBooks and places like that. Thousands and thousands of copies for $10 a book. And it's got all my exact position sizing algorithms that I still use today and have been using for probably 35 years or so. And that's been very well received and is a little more of a technical book. It's not something you want to read. Maybe you want to read it before you go to bed, but it's not something that is like reading a Jack Reacher novel or something like that. There's a little more math involved, and I try to describe why you would want to do this, and then I show you how to do it. And so it's pretty easy to read.
Excellent. Well, that sounds right up my alley. That's something I'll be purchasing. Listeners, go out there and get it.
Yeah, when I think of the three things you need for good trading, you do need a buy-sell decision or some kind of way to buy or sell. You also do need, and more importantly, you need, how much do you buy or sell? Because if you buy too much, you're putting yourself in harm's way. If you buy too little, you're not really helping your cause much. You got to properly size your position. And more so than that, and even more important, and the most important is all the things we talked about in the early going here, is the mental side of trading, the awareness, the discipline, the ability to control your mental states. That is going to mess up everything else you do if you don't have that correct. So you got to get those three things right to be a successful long-term trader. And I think I've worked hard on all three, and I think it's helped me a lot in life. So I would give that advice to every new trader starting out. Don't underestimate the mental, and don't underestimate how important it is to size your positions. And then whatever you can do that makes sense on the buy sell decision, go for it. But don't obsess over buy sell.
Sure.
Worry about those other two a little bit more.
Excellent. Love it. Last question I'll ask you. I forgot where I saw this. Maybe you said in an interview, maybe I read it in one of your bios. But you are a competitive putter. What's a competitive putter? I didn't even know this was a thing.
That's the third book I wrote. you can get that on Amazon, and it's also on the website. And I think it's called Putting, the Easiest Stroke in Golf. What happened is in high school, three buddies of mine and I would go over to Putt-Putt in Eastwood, on the east side of Syracuse, and on a Saturday night, and you would be in a competition with a whole bunch of other putters. And this was serious. I mean, it's stroke play, 108 holes. So you're going around the 54, is it, hole layout twice. And that takes a while. I mean, you're there for hours. They're fogging for mosquitoes and you're sucking in the DDT and everything. and then what you're competing for is like a Big Mac coupon at McDonald's. This is a huge tournament. But some of you might remember on Sunday mornings, there used to be this show that would have putt-putt championships on television. And these are pretty serious. I mean, these guys are good enough that they one-putt everything. And you're on felt. I mean, the surface is perfect. It's planed concrete covered with stimp meter 14 felt. And your competitor, you're looking over at him and he's running everything in. And you're quickly going to start saying, what's he doing that I'm not doing? What's his putter look like versus my putter? What's his grip look like versus my grip? Everything he does. And I started getting better and better at it. And I started getting very, very quiet and slowing my breathing like you're a sharpshooter, trying to take out somebody from 2 miles away, a sniper or something. And I started really, really getting down to the nitpicking every little thing that was involved with putting. And I wrote a book called Putting, the Easiest Stroke in Golf, including pictures of myself doing various things. And I go through everything from the design of the putter to the stroke and all of that. And I haven't sold a lot of those books, but I mostly wrote the book just to consolidate in one place in case I ever forget anything that I'm supposed to be doing. I can read my own book and remind myself and give myself a lesson. So that's kind of the main purpose behind that one. And so that's a third book I've written that's probably had sales of at least a dozen.
Yeah, of at least a dozen. Oh, yeah. Man. Tom, I love it. I love how meticulously you're describing it all translates, from putting to trading, the mindset, the how meticulous you are about it. I wish golf, this is, I got to get this.
Golf and trading is very similar. You never ever arrive. You only get better at it.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I mean, mentally tough game as well. Yeah. I mean, I wish I would have got this book before, Tom. It's funny, we were talking about Tiger Woods living down here right around the corner from me. I believe he's involved with this. They got this like putt-putt place, but it's supposed to be nice. They have a bar and it's like kind of like a little hangout place. And I took a girl there, Tom, and the course was so hard. I was just trying to have a fun time. And I'm missing everything, man. I'm like, why is this course so hard? I thought this would just be a nice like little family friendly or little date night. But this course was hard, man. Putt-putt. I'm like, I gotta get your book, Tom.
You would expect, I keep track of my stats on golf.
Yeah.
And I average just slightly more than 30 putts a round, and I don't even work at it very hard.
Yeah.
If I really worked at it hard, I probably could be down in the 29s, and that's getting to be sort of median level for the PGA Tour.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty good with putting. I've given a lot of putting lessons, and I've redesigned approximately 100 putters over the years, and I've actually built one from scratch myself.
Oh, cool.
So, I've gotten into that over the years. One of my other extraneous hobbies that I've just keeps life interesting.
I'm sure you do a lot of things well, Tom. Last question, because I always like asking guests this. What are you currently reading? Any good books you're currently reading?
Mostly these days I read for enjoyment. So I just read fiction usually before I go to bed, just to quiet down. I like J.D. Robb. It's Nora Roberts' futuristic author name, where she portrays this Eve Dallas, this futuristic cop in New York that's in 2040 or something. And they have, cars that fly around, and they have all sorts of interesting new tools that you could imagine, the way CSI and all the different shows that go over laboratories and evidence. And she's pretty much a kick butt type of lieutenant that runs the homicide squad in a future New York City Police Department. And I love science fiction, and I love thinking about the way things could be. So it's kind of captures my imagination that you could actually have a sort of a thriller or a cop novel. There's lots of those out there, but most of them are real time today. Mm-hmm. And this one's set, you know, like 20, 30, 40 years in the future. So it's kind of fun.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Fiction is something I've just really taken up like the past year or so. I've always been a, you know, a nonfiction reader. Like I want things that are, I guess practical, you could say, but I didn't realize how philosophical fiction can be, or you know, just learning about life through fiction, which has been very enjoyable for myself. Well,
most of my life, I read nonfiction, and I tried to, you know, the things on Observer Self and Awareness, and
yeah,
I've even read books on meditation, although I don't find that as useful for me. I'd rather be aware and keep myself aware of what's going on in my thoughts real time, rather than going off to a dark corner and meditating and trying to examine my thoughts that way. I'd rather be stimulating my thoughts with real world. Yeah. I find it more useful myself, but you know, meditating works for some people. That's great. But I've also read lots of, you know, I read Dress for Success. I read, you know, Think and Grow Rich, all the classics back when I was all sorts of sales books, because I was responsible at this. When you're running Trendstat Capital Management and it's owned by Tom Basso, guess who the clients want to see? Tom Basso. So I'm on the road on a plane going, doing a meeting in front of, you know, 10 people at Merrill Lynch level in New York City, and picking up $100 million from them or something to manage those types of meetings. They want me there. So sales books on how to carry yourself and what to try to think about the sales process and all that. Being the chairman of Standpoint Funds now here in Scottsdale, where they have the alternative, you know, 50-50 futures and stocks, Blendex fund that we have. Gosh, I mean, that type of thing to understand Robert's rules of orders so I can run the meeting, to try to make sure I understand books on corporate law so that I can make sure that we stay within proper minutes and we approve the minutes and how do we do that and all that stuff. I'm the chairman. I'm supposed to run the meeting. So, you know, I've read a lot of technical books like that, but it's so enjoyable at my stage of life to just kick back and read some science fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Oh, and not to keep the conversation and keep going on, but the sales books, okay. I was, you know, before I got into like all the, you know, like poker trading, I was doing sales, and I just learned so much from the sales books. And I think that's just a very underrated skill, in general.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. All right. So Tom, I appreciate it. So that's going to conclude today's episode of Confessions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review it for us. If you'd like to join a professional supportive community of traders, you can join JJ and myself at microefutures.com. Tom, let the listeners know where they can find you and anything else you'd like them to know.
Well, I'm in a lot of places these days. You can look at my website is enjoytheride.world, not .com, .world. It's actually a URL. And I have traders all over the world, so it makes sense to me. You can get me at Twitter as at Basso_Tom. You can like my page or follow my page at Facebook. It's under Tom Basso, and it's the page, not my personal. Don't try to send a friend request, because I only use that for my family. I hardly ever post to it. I post to my page, though. That's where you would get all my posts. I'm on MeWe and Parler. You can just search for my name there. I'm on LinkedIn, and that's been very popular with a lot of people. And so you can find me there by searching on Tom Basso. So I'm in a lot of places these days, thanks to broadcasts like these. So
excellent. Well, we appreciate you sharing your time with us, being gracious enough. JJ, any parting words for Tom?
Oh, thank you so much for being with us today. Really, really, really cool for me to, you meet the people you read about and get grains of wisdom when you're starting out. You know, and you hopefully remember them, but thank you so much for being with us. We really, really appreciate it.
Oh, JJ, it was my pleasure.
All right. Excellent. So for Tom Basso, I'm Paulie Walnuts. He's the gorilla of House Street. You stop. So. Thank you.